Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I just wanted to say a few words about the litany of Shakyamuni Buddha to start. Towards the end of the scripture, it goes through all of these things. Those who wish to become Buddhas should engender supreme bodhicitta and make offerings to the Tathagata. Those who wish to abandon desire, hatred, and ignorance, likewise. Those who wish to become Shakras or Brahmas, that means heavenly beings, soon, attended by a retinue of thousands, and to enjoy never-ending amusements in heavenly palaces, should keep close to the lion of the Shakya clan. I think it's interesting that it doesn't actually say that you'll get those things. It says that if you have that kind of ambition, you want to keep close to the Buddha. And, depending on one's conditions and the like, maybe or maybe not. But the important thing is to take refuge in the Buddha. I think another thing here as it goes through this list is that what it said in the offertory about the Buddha being very skilled in harmonizing different kinds of people. So this is talking about all different sorts of people that have different desires and things that they think are important, aspirations, maybe ambitions. And it's just saying the Buddha knows how to help and teach all of them. And the other thing is, it says how the Buddha, now he will enter the city. The picture that I have, whether or not this is accurate, is that when the Buddha was enlightened, he was alone in the forest, sitting under a Bodhi tree. And then after his enlightenment, or after what we call his enlightenment, with that first insight, he wasn't sure that there was anyone who could understand what he had realized. And so he thought at that point that maybe the best thing to do would just be to pass into nirvana, to die. And then one of the celestials read his thoughts and thought, wait a minute, you have a lot to offer, and came and encouraged him. So when it says he will enter the city, that's saying he will leave his place in the forest and come and help living things. And so it's through that that we got the teaching that we've got now. Another way you can look at it is that he comes from the forest to us. You know, we're the city, if you will. So the teaching that he understood and then learned how to teach has come to us, and is just as much something that comes to us as was the case at the time of his life a couple of thousand years ago. It's still here. And the Buddha still enters the city. So, the next thing is what I want to talk about today. Okay, the last few times we've been talking about a writing by Great Master Dogen, who is the founder of the Soto Zen tradition in Japan, and we have inherited that. And the scripture is called the Shushogi, which means what is truly meant by training and enlightenment. So what it means to train and what we're talking about when we speak about enlightenment. And this particular chapter of it is called Awakening to the Mind of the Bodhisattva. There's a saying that when you wish to help and enlighten all living things, you're in delusion. And when all living things are all things, help and enlighten you, then you're in enlightenment. And so when we talk about the Bodhisattva, well, the Bodhisattva means enlightenment being, or one who is awakening to what in their heart they know is true. Awakening to the mind of the Bodhisattva. So I'll just read this chapter and then go back and talk about the details of it. when one awakens to true wisdom, it means that one is willing to save all living things before one has actually saved oneself. Whether a being is a layman, priest, god, or man, enjoying pleasure or suffering pain, he should awaken this desire as quickly as possible. However humble a person may appear to be, if this desire has been awakened, he is already the teacher of all mankind. A little girl of 7 even may be the teacher of the 4 classes of Buddhists and the mother of true compassion to all living things. One of the greatest teachings of Buddhism is its insistence upon the complete equality of the sexes. However much one may drift in the 6 worlds and the 4 existences, even they become a means for realizing the desire for Buddhahood once it has been awakened. However much time we may have wasted up to now, there is still time to awaken this desire. Although our own merit for Buddhahood may be full ripe, it is our bounden duty to use all this merit for the purpose of enlightening every living thing. At all times, there have been those who put their own Buddhahood second to the necessity of working for the good of all other living things. The 4 wisdoms, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, are the means we have of helping others and represent the Bodhisattva's aspirations. Charity is the opposite of covetousness. We make offerings although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. There is no need to be concerned about how small the gift may be, so long as it brings true results. For even if it is only a single phrase or verse of teaching, it may be a seed to bring forth good fruit both now and hereafter. Similarly, the offering of only 1 coin or a blade of grass can cause the arising of good, for the teaching itself is the true treasure, and the true treasure is the very teaching. We must never desire any reward, and we must always share everything we have with others. It is an act of charity to build a ferry or a bridge, and all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. To behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them is the meaning of tenderness. If one would understand tenderness, one must speak to others whilst thinking that one loves all living things as if they were one's own children. By praising those who exhibit virtue and feeling sorry for those who do not, our enemies become our friends, and they who are our friends have their friendship strengthened. This is all through the power of tenderness. Whenever one speaks kindly to another, his face brightens and his heart is warmed. If a kind word be spoken in his absence, the impression will be a deep one. Tenderness can have a revolutionary impact upon the mind of man. If one creates wise ways of helping beings, whether they be in high places or lowly stations, one exhibits benevolence. No reward was sought by those who rescued the helpless tortoise and the 6 sparrow, these acts being utterly benevolent. The stupid believe that they will lose something if they give help to others, but this is completely untrue, for benevolence helps everyone, including oneself, being a law of the universe. If one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, one can understand the true meaning of sympathy. Take, for example, the fact that the Buddha appeared in the human world in the form of a human being. Sympathy does not distinguish between oneself and others. There are times when the self is infinite, and times when this is true of others. sympathy is as the sea, in that it never refuses water from whatsoever source it may come. All waters may gather and form only one sea. O you seekers of enlightenment, meditate deeply upon these teachings and do not make light of them. Give respect and reverence to their merit, which brings blessing to all living things. Help all beings to cross over to the other shore. Now, the wish to realize Buddhahood, which is sometimes called supreme bodhicitta, and is here called the awakening to the mind of a bodhisattva, comes out of the merit of non-action and non-seeking. And it comes out of the learning to keep the spirit of the precepts. So the precepts are those ways that we restrain the selfish self, and also the ways that we take refuge. The three pure collective precepts encompass all of them in the sense that all of them talk about ceasing from evil and doing what is good and doing good for others. So the wish to realize the mind of a bodhisattva again comes naturally out of our efforts to train ourselves, our efforts to practice meditation and to take care of how we relate to others. And this is, again, the merit of non-action and non-seeking. In other words, we're not pursuing a personal ideal or striving after a personal standard. We're trying to understand naturally what at heart we already know and understand. We possess the same nature as the Buddha did. And it's through meditation and the keeping of the precepts that we can learn to fully recognize and trust that. When one awakens to true wisdom, it means that one is willing to save all living things before one has actually saved oneself. Now, it can seem to contradict what I just said about if you think you're going to teach and enlighten everyone else, you're in delusion. But there has to be a heart and an intent to just have a good heart for all living things, to respect that they as much value their life as you do yours. And that's true not just of other people, but of animals, insects. I would say the kinds of sentient beings that generally aren't recognized by science, but I'll leave that up to you to, you don't have to believe that unless you find it helpful. Anyway, so a lot of this comes down to intent, just to have a good heart for others. Whether a being is a layman, priest, god, or man, enjoying pleasure or suffering pain, he should awaken this desire as quickly as possible. And what that means is that you can awaken it, no matter what situation you find yourself in. You can awaken that heart that has values and respects others' lives as your own. However humble a person may appear to be, if this desire has been awakened, he is already the teacher of all mankind. Really what this means is that just simply by having that intent and by doing your own practice, you help and teach others. You don't even have to be conscious or aware of how that works. It's just simply enough to be aware of who's around you and to have a kind heart for them and help where help is needed. And leave people alone when leaving them alone is what's needed. It's very much a delicate balance. A little girl of 7 even may be the teacher of the 4 classes of Buddhists and the mother of true compassion to all living things. And that's a reference to a scripture in which there was a little girl of 7 who clearly had a better understanding of the Buddha's teaching than anyone else present at that point in time. And I think it's also pointing to the fact that children have a natural sense of Buddha nature, even if they can't put it into words, and even if they sometimes may be overwhelmed by what adults tell them they ought to think and the like, that they have that natural sense of center and balance. So that little girl of seven is also each of us and the child that still lives within us. And that through meditation we can become more clearly aware of. A little girl of seven even may be the teacher of the four classes of Buddhists. And the four classes of Buddhists are male and female monks and male and female lay trainees, all of which are spiritual equals. One of the greatest teachings of Buddhism is its insistence upon the complete equality of the sexes. That's the teaching, and the practice varies, but the teaching is there and has been from the very beginning. However much one may drift in the six worlds and the four existences, even they become a means for realizing the desire for Buddhahood once it has been awakened. However much time we may have wasted up to now, there is still time to awaken this desire. So the six worlds are basically the six, you can view it as six worlds into which one can be reborn, or as six frames of mind running from heaven to hell, hungry ghosts, ambitious asuras, animals, basically the sphere of all different kinds of beings. The four existences, again, refer to the four classes of Buddhists, so male and female monks, male and female lay trainees, sometimes called the fourfold assembly. However much time we may have wasted up to now, which is really, you know, we're the ones who judge whether we've wasted our time or not, but whatever we think of ourselves or how much time we may have wasted, that doesn't mean that it's too late. Doesn't matter how old you are, how sick you are, whatever situation you're in, you can still awaken that wish to have a good heart for others. Although our own merit for Buddhahood may be full ripe, it is our bounden duty to use all this merit for the purpose of enlightening every living thing. At all times, there have been those who put their own Buddhahood second to the necessity of working for the good of all other living things. And what it means there by Buddhahood is enlightenment. And basically what that is saying is that if you would really understand what the Buddha awoke to, what he was enlightened to, you have to understand that he didn't separate himself off from others. In fact, he turned from the awakening to that great refuge that he found within himself to learning how to show that to others in the best way he knew how. He had to be reminded of it, but he did recognize that that was possible and that was his intent. And it entailed for him considerable hardship. And so in the scripture we recited this morning, it talks about how he learned to overcome fatigue and exhaustion, how he learned patience, all in order to help others. The four wisdoms, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, are the means we have of helping others, and represent the Bodhisattva's aspirations. Now, it seems to me that a lot of what these are talking about is not just about, you know, you helping others, but all of us working together and all of us learning how to practice together. So it's about harmony in the Sangha. It's about getting along with others, whether you feel like it or not. And there are times when, you know, we have difficulty with others, but being willing to continue training. And these are the four means we have of learning how to get along with others, and how to learn from them, and how to recognize the bodhisattva in them as well. So in a way, it's about recognition of what the bodhisattva mind actually is. Charity is the opposite of covetousness. We make offerings, although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. So there's a sense there of generosity. Charity, I think the word charity has perhaps a stronger religious sense to it, which really means faith, in the sense of which we use that in Buddhism, which is faith that there is something greater than ourselves and that we all possess it and that we can learn to recognize it. Faith that there is something there. It doesn't mean faith in the sense of just believe what's written here. It means find out what it means for you, because at heart you know what it means and you can find it through looking within yourself. We make offerings, although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. So it's getting out of that head of saying, well, what's in it for me? I think everyone comes to Buddhism or to meditation in any form thinking, well, this should benefit me. So there's not really anything wrong with saying, what's in it for me? But if you would really understand what's in it for you, you have to understand that you're not separate from all living things. And so by having a good heart for others, you also have a good heart for yourself. And you can't really separate yourself off. And in a way, it's as much a mistake in Buddhism to leave yourself out of the picture and to recognize that, you know, you have to have compassion for yourself and understand what your limits are and make allowance for that. That's as much a part of having a good heart for all living things as recognizing the same for, you know, giving others the benefit of the doubt. There is no need to be concerned about how small the gift may be, so long as it brings true results. For even if it is only a single phrase or verse of teaching, it may be a seed to bring forth good fruit, both now and hereafter. Well, what are true results? It's really that sense of connection or communication. And we know that, you know, when we say something to someone else, we know if they understand it or if there's a sense of recognition and connection there. And often enough, we learn what the true results are by what didn't work. So, you know, that's part of the process of training. Similarly, the offering of only one coin or a blade of grass can cause the arising of good. For the teaching itself is the true treasure, and the true treasure is the very teaching. To me, there's a bit of a koan there. The teaching is the true treasure, and the true treasure is the very teaching. To me, what it says is, yes, there is a true treasure. There is something true that's greater than ourselves, and that's worth trying to understand. And what it is what helps and teaches us. And that can be anything. So it's here. It's here with us. It's not something unattainable. And so, like with the altar here, when we look at the figure of the Buddha, we always say that you're looking at yourself and what you have the potential to understand yourself. That's the true treasure. We must never desire any reward, and we must always share everything we have with others. It is an act of charity to build a ferry or a bridge, and all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. So here you can look around you and see what people are working on, what they're working at, and recognize that it does help others. It doesn't have to be religious, but if you look at it with what I would call religious eyes, with the eyes of faith, you can recognize the others, no matter, you know, who they are or what they're doing. To behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them is the meaning of tenderness. So if charity is a generous heart, or having a generous attitude towards others, which leads into your action, it also leads naturally to kind speech. And out of charity comes tenderness. If one would understand tenderness, one must speak to others whilst thinking that one loves all living things as if they were one's own children. Does that need explanation? I think that's pretty obvious. By praising those who exhibit virtue and feeling sorry for those who do not, our enemies become our friends, and they who are our friends have their friendship strengthened. So virtue always entails some relinquishment of self. Those who do not exhibit virtue in some way showing some element of selfishness, greed or hatred or delusion, confusion. Feeling sorry for those who do not, I think, is simply recognizing that they're suffering and that they are bringing suffering on themselves. And it's only through having a kind heart that you can help them, and that may mean just simply getting out of their way. Depends on if you're in a close relationship with someone. There's a delicate and sometimes difficult balance there. People aren't perfect. Monks aren't perfect. I'm not even sure they're supposed to be perfect. They're human. Anyone who's lived long in a monastery will know that there are tensions that arise all the time, and sometimes there are certain people that you always kind of grate with. And yet, if you keep your focus on doing your training, over time those differences do soften and sometimes completely turn around. This is all through the power of tenderness. Whenever one speaks kindly to another, his face brightens and his heart is warmed. If a kind word be spoken in his absence, the impression will be a deep one. Tenderness can have a revolutionary impact upon the mind of man. Again, it's those small efforts and those small gestures that don't seem like much, and yet over time they accumulate and they do have a positive effect, both on oneself and on those around you, even if you can't always pin it down and measure it. But I think most of us, if you look at where we were before we started meditating and where we are now, we'll see that there are differences and changes for the better. For most of us, I would say, yeah. I think there are times when you look at yourself in the mirror and go, there's just so much more to do. And that's, there is more to do. If one creates wise ways of helping beings, whether they be in high places or lowly stations, one exhibits benevolence. No reward was sought by those who rescued the helpless tortoise and the sick sparrow, these acts being utterly benevolent. I don't remember the exact details of these two stories, but they're stories that are part of the wisdom of Chinese culture. And someone who saw a tortoise that was about to be sold at market and bought the tortoise himself and then released it. And it's said that he later on became a high administrator in the government, and they made a special seal for him to seal documents, and while they were carving the seal, it always seemed to come out in the shape of a tortoise, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. They kept trying to recarve it, and it kept coming out that way. And then the minister realized that, oh, this is the tortoise trying to tell me something about how I got here to where I can benefit others through my position. And so he kept the tortoise seal. And the sixth sparrow is another similar story about a little boy who saw a sixth sparrow and brought it and nursed it back to health and let it go. And later on, I can't remember what the reward was, but the sense was that by doing a kindness to someone else when there was really no requirement to do so, brought merit back to the person concerned. And they didn't go looking for a reward. They just did what they could to help others. And, you know, if you think about the position of the minister, yeah, there was merit involved. And look at the tremendous responsibility that also fell on him. So, yes, it's merit. And that doesn't mean that you can just sort of revel in it. You know, it comes with a responsibility to keep going with your training. The stupid believe that they will lose something if they give help to others. But this is completely untrue, for benevolence helps everyone, including oneself, being a law of the universe. The stupid, I'm not sure that that's being said in a judgmental tone. It's more like, you know, people who tend to act from their animal nature don't really care that much about others, maybe, and so have something to learn. So think of stupid there as people who have something to learn. Well, here we are. Who doesn't have something to learn? If one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, one can understand the true meaning of sympathy. Take, for example, the fact that the Buddha appeared in the human world in the form of a human being. Sympathy does not distinguish between oneself and others. Now, on face value, that just means being sympathetic to others' feelings. It also means being open to and sympathetic to the aspects of yourself that you would just as soon disown. And being sympathetic to that means learning to accept yourself as you are, with all of your shortcomings and fears and whatever, selfishnesses, in whatever form they may be. To be willing to accept those and understand, and this is very fundamental to Buddhist teaching, that no matter what the wrong is or what the wrongdoing has been, at the heart of it is something sincere and pure. And a lot of the restraint of the precepts is about helping us to come back to recognizing what that pure intent was. And that can run very deep, and it can take a lifetime, maybe many lifetimes, to fully understand. But there is that faith that no matter what we think of ourselves or what we've done in the past, we can find that pure heart. And we can learn to recognize it and learn to live from that place. O you seekers of enlightenment, meditate deeply upon these teachings and do not make light of them. Give respect and reverence to their merit, which brings blessing to all living things. Help all beings to cross over to the other shore. Now, going all through here, you can see how one or other of the precepts kind of works under the surface of what he's saying here. In this case, do not make light of these teachings. Do not defame the three treasures, is the way the precept is phrased. Speak kindly to others. Do not speak against others, is another of the precepts. So all through this, you can see in training to help others and to recognize their bodhisattva essence also is through learning to keep the spirit of the precepts. Now, when we do the ceremony or the retreat for taking the precepts, there are five ceremonies that corresponds to each of the chapters of this scripture. And the ceremony that corresponds to this chapter is called, in Japanese, the Kechimiyaku. And what that translates as is following where the precepts, as the lifeblood of the Buddhas, lead. So following where the precepts lead, recognizing that the precepts themselves are the lifeblood of all the Buddhas. So awakening to the mind of the Bodhisattva means going where the precepts lead us, and we can't know where that will be. The ceremony that goes with this, the celebrant leads a procession, and the celebrant follows no prescribed path. So it's, again, the merit of non-action and non-seeking. It winds here and there in order to show those who follow different aspects of the teaching that may be helpful to them. I remember once my master, when leading this ceremony, we went around the monastery and eventually went by the septic tank. And what's that thing? Well, there are parts of us that need to be cleaned up. And then eventually the winding path comes back to the ceremony hall, and the celebrant of the ceremony climbs the stairs that go up the altar and then sits on the altar. And those who follow will come up the stairs, and then the celebrant will give them the Kechimiyaku certificate. For those of you who have taken the precepts, it's a certificate recognizing that you have formally received the precepts, following where the precepts lead. And what's it saying but that ultimately the precepts lead up the altar? So lead you to climb that mountain of self, and that when you reach the top of it, there is that which the Buddha awoke to. And then you come back down and go on with your lives. Continue your training.